Welcome to the Tech Nori Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Today's show is brought to you by ActiveCampaign. Actually, I would tell you the live read is see why 100,000 businesses use ActiveCampaign by signing up at activecampaign.com/technori and get your first 2 months free. I guess I did say it. I actually bring up the story in the show, and it's completely just a free plug on the fact that I'm a big fan of ActiveCampaign and its founder, Jason Vandenboom. One of the all-time great Tech Nori stories is got to be ShipBob. That's our guest today. Divi Gulati is the co-founder of ShipBob. They were on our stage. They raised, I found this out after the show, they raised like something like $500,000 literally right after they pitched on Tech Nori in 2015. And it just is like an all-time great, not just because I love the name ShipBob, but a company that the founders believed in who they were and what they do. They didn't deviate. They didn't, they welcomed the pivots that were challenging. They stayed the course. They wrote a mission statement down. They followed the mission statement. I think it's a storyline that I could not tell you more. I know that it's a lot of fun to say fail fast and, you know, shout out struggle porn on Instagram and be on shows where everyone's talking about how huge and bold they are. I have to tell you, I have a list of 1,000 companies, at least, that have been on this podcast, on my radio show, on my stage, 500 on stage, including ShipBob. And if I go through that list, I might find five or so, maybe 10. I don't think I'd get to double digits, who went whale hunting and broke shit and went fast and that was it and blah, 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 that survived. The vast majority of them did not. And the amount of capital that went down the toilet with them flushed right alongside of them. The number of companies that I have on stage that did it like ShipBob that are now 100 million plus companies, dozens. When I say dozens, I mean it literally. We've had over 28 exits that I know of, over $1 billion in capital raised. But what I would stick to in this whole thing is that the companies that we had on that had the most success similar to ShipBob were built on a mission. They knew who they were. They knew what their strengths were. They knew how they were going to create a competitive advantage. It wasn't just spray and pray. It wasn't flinging money at marketing. It wasn't making crazy valuations. And I know you hear all the time, and I'm one of the people who says it sometimes, that Chicago raises money a little slower than they should. And they do. But part of that is also the reason why we have a lot of success. And it's founders who recognize that if you can be exceptional at the small things, eventually, if you're good, you will get a shot at the big ones. And if you're exceptional at the small ones, you will be exceptional with the big ones. And the key here, and we talk about it on the show, the key here is if I am an enterprise business and I have 8 customers and they make up 80% of my money, or even worse, which is more typical. It's like I have 3 customers that make up 80%+ of my revenue. If 1, 2, or 3 of them fall or leave me, which they're getting pitched every single day, thus the whale, I'm done. I have very little time to scramble. And anyone in this business knows exactly how long it takes to land a big customer. It could be 6 months, 9 months, 18 months. It is variable. That said, if I focused on the small things and I just did my job well, and 70% of my revenue is made up of onesie twosies, I can lose 5, 10, 10, 15 customers and get them back and get a couple more and then throw on a whale. And now all of a sudden I've got, 10% of my revenue coming from one, 70% of my revenue coming from small, 10 to 20% of my revenue coming from midsize. It is so much safer. Now you don't need as much capital to do it, usually. And it's just, I don't know. There's something about it that I think people on the coast get bored with. And I'm okay with that because I'm sitting here flush with cash trying to throw money at startups. And I would be very happy if every company that I looked at said to me, you know what? I'm only focused on one thing, unit economics. I want to know how much money it costs to get my customer. And I only want to spend that on the customers that I get and keep. And those customers usually spend 3 to 5 times what the initial was over the lifetime, maybe more. You say that to me and my money's flying out of my pocket. If you say to me, I got this gigantic, brilliant idea and you're going to fling a bunch of money. And if you land it, cough Quibi, you're going to be in the money. I'm not saying I'm not going to listen. I'm listening. I like to take crazy risks as much as the next guy. But I am not nearly as excited about the potential. I usually look at that and go, that's a 90-10. 10% chance of success, that 10% yields a gazillion dollars. And the wife and I live in, I don't even know, Montana. Montana, you can go back to hanging out outside, right? I'll wait on that one. We're going to go somewhere that still has social distancing. But the point remains, 90% chance of failure. Love companies that have somewhere between 60 and 40% chance of success. And it's assumed that they get a couple of things right. Those are the companies I like. Divi is the founder of one of such companies, ShipBob. And so I don't even need to say anymore. I think you listen to the show. And if you listen to this one, you like it. You'll also like, I mentioned it in the show, but you'll like it. Ohi founder Ben Jones is a previous podcast a couple of weeks ago. If you like this, you'll like that. You should listen to both. Also, if you're mulling around Spotify listening to Technori podcasts, you should go down the music aisle. And if this were a Best Buy, I'm not sure why I just went into retail. I guess it's from this conversation. But you go down the aisle a little bit on Spotify and check out the Technori podcast. We update the music every single Friday. It's been a blast. For anything else, you can follow us on Instagram. Follow me on Twitter at Katoon or at Technori. So this is my conversation with the co-founder of ShipBob, Technori alum 2015, one of the top success stories, Divi Gulati. The change in the last, call it 2 years, of expectations being one day delivery, overnight delivery, or at the very minimum, just the flexibility of the end user, whether that's B2C or B2B, having a lot of control and a lot of expectation now when they buy things that everything gets shipped to them and it gets shipped to them in a timely manner and that's not something that results in them having to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars to overnight stuff. I'd just love to know your take on this and sort of the evolution of this world, the shipping world, over the last, really since Jeff Bezos and those guys at Amazon, those crazy Amazon guys, made this ludicrous promise of same day shipping.
Yeah, I think there are two industry dynamics that happened, let's say, early in 2010s to 2016, 2017. So one was definitely Amazonification of commerce, where Amazon launched Amazon Prime late last decade, and it took off this decade, essentially, in the beginning of this decade, and then Amazon upped the ante by essentially going from two-day to same-day or next-day delivery as a standard. So that was a great thing for consumers, and obviously the consumer expectations started to evolve and change to expect that kind of customer service. But then, if you think on the other side, Amazon and Walmarts of the world, who have such heavy investment in their infrastructure, their logistics, they were able to achieve this. But then that put pressure on the other segment of the market, which is, let's say, the small to mid-sized e-commerce businesses, these direct-to-consumer brands, who were now in a place where they had to provide similar type of customer experience, if not better, to the same consumers who are buying on Amazon and also buying from these small to mid-sized consumer businesses. So that was one thing that happened, which is Amazonification of commerce. But then the other, I would say, change in the industry was it became easier and easier to start an e-commerce business online. And how that happened was essentially with the rise of companies like Shopify, like Stripe, Instagram, that changed the entire market dynamic as well. So back in the day, let's say in early 2000s, if you had to start your own e-commerce business, the only way was essentially to hire an engineer like myself, because I'm an engineer, and essentially pay them dollars to build your website, and then hire a marketer or figure out how to market in a cost-efficient manner and pour a decent amount of money in the marketing, because social media didn't really exist as much, and the only way to advertise were traditional ways or, well, let's say Google or some more websites where you couldn't advertise. So it was very hard to, well, launch a brand and then to scale up a brand. But then Shopify came about, BigCommerce came about, WooCommerce made it easy, and Squarespace also entered the market. So essentially a lot of these platforms entered the market and made it virtually seamless and pretty painless to launch an e-commerce company. And now, like, if you want to launch an e-commerce company, it takes less than 30 minutes to at least get you started on these platforms.
Yeah, and then, it's that part is, I think, the craziest thing. And then the other part, and I want you to finish the thought, but I just add into this, it's like the customer is now so used to this behavior and experience that, like, there is no going back. It is essentially a non-option. If you're a business and you think that you don't have to be able to offer single day or close to that, if you're a 7 days to get the product, the likelihood of you succeeding is almost nil at this point.
Yeah, because ultimately there are a few core tenets of consumer behavior that Amazon was playing to, and that is going to stay true. People will want things faster and they'll always want it cheaper. And that's where Amazon excelled. And that's why all consumers are expecting two-day, same-day delivery from these small businesses that are now starting out. And again, these small businesses now have to figure out a way to essentially have the same customer experience and get the item delivered within 2 days. And how Amazon does it on a very high level is through a network of fulfillment centers, if you think about it. Amazon has 100-plus fulfillment centers that they've created. And when you're shipping an order to, let's say, yourself in Chicago, the order is not originating from their California fulfillment center. It is actually getting shipped from the closest fulfillment center right next to Chicago. And all this change essentially has enabled a few more companies to exist and innovate on the logistics side. And ShipBob, where I'm one of the founders, we exist because of this consumer behavior change. And also, like, as we see more and more small businesses coming online with Shopify, with BigCommerce, with WooCommerce. So we're catering to that market and bringing them at the same customer experience level like Amazon.
Yeah. And I mean, you are, as we talked about before the show, kind of a Technori OG. You guys pitched the company on stage at Technori. And obviously now it's a quite literally a different world in so many ways. And I'm not even talking about the corona like that. There's a million other things that have changed since you were pitched on stage. I'd love to go back to your original pitch of who you were going to be, what you were going to be, and look at who you are now and sort of talk about it. Like, are you the same thing you thought you were going to be? Are you different? Are you better? Is the world different? Like, what was that thought for you when you pitched in the beginning compared to now? What's that journey look like?
Yeah. So when I pitched last time, it was, I think, back in 2015, 2016 timeframe.
Yep.
And what I would say between now and then, I think we've grown a lot and we are in a much better spot than I would have ever imagined. And to give you some background, essentially, ShipBob's mission when we started back in 2014 was to help e-commerce businesses be successful by giving them best-in-class logistics. So that mission statement is still true. We're still catering to the small to mid-sized e-commerce businesses. We're still solving their logistical problems or logistical challenges and getting them to the Amazon level. But how we do it has evolved a little bit. So back in the day, the thesis was that these small businesses have inventory in their garages and their apartments, and, well, they just need help with shipping and logistics, because when we were running our own e-commerce business, the physical part of packaging and shipping was the most painful part. So in 2014, when we started, we would literally go to these e-commerce businesses, pick up their inventory, get it back to our fulfillment centers or our warehouses, package them and ship them out the same day. And then as we started scaling, our customers told us that they didn't want to hold this inventory. And as they started scaling, it was hard for them to keep their inventory in their garage. And that's when we actually opened a fulfillment centers where we would store their inventory for, let's say, a certain time frame. And when the orders come in, with the help of technology, we would literally automate everything and pick, pack, and ship these orders out in a timely manner. And then we started developing these algorithms further, where now, let's say we have 9 fulfillment centers across the country. Now we're telling our merchants where they should be placing their inventory based on the demand patterns that we see on their website or across their industry. So now we're able to help them make smarter decisions in placing their inventory in the right spot And when the order comes in, we're able to choose the cheapest carrier possible, like first class even in certain cases, and get it delivered within 2 business days.
I have to tell you, I mean, that had to be a pretty, I don't want to say nervous or scary, but it's like, that's a huge opportunity to fulfillment centers. Like, we're going to go start opening up fulfillment centers, and that may have been on the roadmap, but you know that there's a gigantic opportunity there as you see sort of the evolution of e-commerce. But that had to be a pretty scary, nervous time, because you're essentially taking on the liability that the mom and pop shops didn't want to take on. The store, the actual physical space, paying for the space, managing inventory, holding on to, you know, goods, and being able to efficiently get them in and out of the space. Like, I feel like you're basically taking away what could be their largest burden. But of course, with that is a huge opportunity to you, but it's also a huge responsibility. What was that? I mean, was that decision hard? Was it like, oh no, we got this, we got it figured out, we know what we're doing? Or was it like, oh my God, we're going from this company where we're hanging out here doing this thing, and we're mostly digital, and we're mostly Dash and engineering and algorithms, to we're physical spaces? What was that transition like for you? Or was it just natural evolution?
Yeah, so we always had smaller footprint, because when we were picking the orders up with drivers, which were mostly contractors, they would drop it off at our warehouse where we would package. Yep. What this did was it kind of blew it up to a different scale. And while that was a difficult decision because, well, we have software investors who invested in us, but they understood we'll be in logistics space. So it was a slightly different, difficult decision, but it was the right decision. And the core premise, which was the mission statement of the company, helped us guide the way. And it may sound very cheesy, but that was literally what we went back to. Okay, what is the mission statement? To help e-commerce businesses be successful by giving them best-in-class logistics. Can we do it by software only? The answer was always no, because there are a lot of warehouses out there. There are a lot of warehouse operators out there, and they're decent businesses, but they were built in an era where they were shipping to retailers, so they were shipping pallets, which is like a lot of quantity, or they were shipping to cases to Macy's or Nordstrom or like these retailers, and they were not meant for e-commerce fulfillment. And the second thing was they just didn't have the right skill set or the right tools to even fulfill e-commerce order for a large number of small merchants, because all these warehouses always wanted the next Casper or the next largest D2C brand, next Tommy Hilfiger, and wanted to fulfill for them. Whereas for small to mid-sized e-commerce businesses, the problem is slightly different. You're not working with one large brand. You're working with a lot of small brands. And in totality, their volume might be equal to large brand, but the complexities of managing such a large number of customers was a different challenge. So that's when we were making a decision. We went back to our mission statement, and then we realized it's a hard problem to solve, but that's where like the technology meets the physical world, and that is a moat that we wanted to create. And the operational complexity in the end becomes a moat for ShipBob, because any other company which will try to replicate what ShipBob is doing, it's going to take them a lot of time and a lot of money to figure it out. And we've already figured most of those pieces out ourselves.
So that's something I would love to drill in with you a little bit, because I think it's, I don't know how to put this. I don't want to talk down to an audience of founders and people, but there is this assumption a lot of times, particularly on the pitch deck side, where we create this mission statement and the idea is like, oh, you know, it sounds cool. It's like kind of the linchpin for our brand guidelines and whatever. And it's like, no, not really. It is your compass. And if you don't set a very, very specific, very traceable mission statement that you can go back to, when the shit hits the fan and you actually have to start picking up the pieces in the wind, you literally only have the mission statement and a couple of components of your business plan to rely on. It is literally like the guide. And I feel like you're a living testament to the importance and the value of that. And then honestly, to your point, I mean, I could not agree more with you that the moat, as you put it, you know, the barrier to entry for anyone else who wants to get into this is extraordinarily high, which is why the value proposition is so good for you. I mean, it's a high risk in your mind at that exact time, but ultimately it's because it's so complex that not everyone or anyone really can solve it in the moment. If you're able to solve it, you unlock a gigantic fortune potentially. Can you talk a little bit more about the sort of the, you know, as you're navigating that, Are you looking at this thinking like, you know, not only is there a huge opportunity for us, but it also almost creates extra time or space between competitors because we have found ourselves in a place that the only way for a competitor to get to is to have gone through it? Is that sort of the thinking?
Exactly. So I think the biggest thing that we thought was, what are we trying to solve? So the problem statement, which was the mission, was fairly easy, and that was always the case. And what we had decided back in the day, we'll try to tackle this problem for the masses and we'll never focus on a few customers only. Like, so there are two ways to building a business. You go enterprise where you have 10 customers and you just focus on those 10 customers and essentially build the company that way. You can get to, let's say, $100 million if you have $10 million customers, 10 of them. The other way is you build a $100 million company with a million customers where everyone's giving you $100.
Yep.
We decided to take the latter route almost. The reason was that was the underserved market. There were larger players that were catering to the million-dollar brands or like multi-hundred-million-dollar brands already. And we wanted to focus on the underserved market where the competition inherently is less and then slowly move up market from there. So it was a very deliberate decision. And ultimately, we knew if we are able to crack it for hundreds of thousands of essentially small to mid-sized e-commerce business, the volume will be large enough where A, we won't have any reliance on any one merchant. So even if that merchant churns away, that's okay. We have the rest of the hundreds of thousands of merchants to make up. And that builds, I would say, more scalability in the business and less reliance on one single individual business on a very high level. And essentially, if you are able to solve the problem for all these complex numbers of merchants, what you can do is at any point of time, you can go back to the simpler model, which these other players were doing. So that gives us a long-term competitive advantage as well. And that was the thinking behind, okay, should we embark on this very difficult journey right now? Yes, if we're successful, then we have such a strong operational moat in the current customer segment, but that opens up an opportunity for the simpler segment for us at a later stage as well. And there's no shortcut here. Like, technology alone cannot solve the problem. You have to literally build the full stack yourself, like Amazon did, to understand the complexities to essentially scale it exponentially.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's like at the end of the day, there's no right or wrong answer per se, kind of as you put it, but the fact remains that you play to your strengths. So if I happen to have high level relationships at, you know, Walmart's a bad example, but if I were at Walmart or Target or something where I could land this big whale, you know, I would do that and take the money and work on it. But the reality of the matter is, like, I'm always one competitor away from insolvency, because those gigantic enterprise clients, if they leave you, which they are always looking for new opportunities, they could do any time, that could be 60% of your business. And then you're left with really no real move other than to land another whale, which, as you know, is very difficult. Where you took a much harder sort of, call it a micro, scale to it. It's more difficult and more time consuming and more organizationally intensive, but it is far safer. And if you become in that regard, in the losing of customer percentage regard, but also if you are exceptional at that and become exceptional at that, then over time you can get some of the big whales. And on top of that, you already have the 100,000 other customers. So at any given time, your valuation, your company, in my opinion, at least, like if I look as an investor, I'm far more interested in a company that has a ton of volume as a business, but then also adds one or two big fish in the pond. And now you look like, you know, there is no end in sight for your growth. But then also just piling on to that point almost a little bit is the fact that when you have these large customers, this conversation reminds me of talking to Jason Vanderboom from ActiveCampaign. He's like, you know, there's Salesforce, there's HubSpot, these other ones that are chasing 1,000 employee customers. And I look at it like, I'm here to help the 5 to 50, you know, person employee companies. And now they have 100,000 worldwide of those customers. And then, hey, look, what do you know? Last year they inked a deal with Salesforce to partner on their the SMB Essentials model. And now they're starting to layer in those, you know, couple hundred to 1,000 employee-led companies. And, you know, the future, they raised $100 million just recently at a gigantic valuation. The future couldn't be brighter for ActiveCampaign. It just took them 12 years to get there, but they were profitable the entire way. And that, I think, is when I look at your story, I look at Jason's story, it's like, it just, and it's the same thing I could throw in younger founders, even Farmer's Fridge, Luke Saunders is another example, where like every single turn and twist that we talk to him, he's like, yeah, people are whipping ideas and things at us, but it's like, no, we're going to stay the course. We're going to build an infrastructure that's just really, you know, it is our defense.
Exactly. And I think it's all about repeatability and scalability. At the same time, like, stick to your strengths. Technology is our strength. And if we would have gone whale hunting in the beginning, we would have customized our offering to for every single merchant or every single client we would have gotten at that point.
Yeah.
Whereas we wanted to build a technology first company. So by the number of masses or the number of people you're onboarding or servicing at that point, essentially, if you're in hundreds of thousands, you can't customize your offering for everyone. So you find ways to scale in a very repeatable way. And you do customizations, but also in a very scalable way. And I think that became the mantra of our company at that point, that we will target these small businesses and we'll customize, but in a very scalable way. Because then if we are customizing for one customer, we should be able to repeat that customization for across these thousand other merchants.
I mean, honestly, you know, you are one of a handful of very successful stories from Technori stage. And I would say that while there are a handful that I can think of that did go whale hunting and succeeded, and they leveraged, you know, a lot of insurtech, they had those relationships. It made sense. But I think if you were to look back at most of the companies that we've had that are successful, they took an approach similar to yours, which was to actually achieve true scale. You need to build something that's repeatable and it's not interrupted, or not any majority percentage of our development time is spent for any one customer. And that ultimately is what ends up having sort of this peg leg thing where you go around in circles and you don't get success, because you have to turn and twist and change everything every single time you onboard someone new. I love that approach. And I just think it is a testament to you and the team, obviously, but it's also like, it's almost like looking into a crystal ball. Like, you, if I would have told you in 2015 or 16, hey, guess what? In about 5 years, there's going to be a pandemic and it's going to shift everything on its head. And all of these businesses are going to be operating remotely. And there's all these different things that you're seeing right now, which I'd love for you to share anything that you're seeing in the kind of during and post corona market. You couldn't have built a platform better for a circumstance like this.
Yeah, and I think we got lucky. Like, I wish I could say I had a crystal ball or we had all the bright minds in one room. Well, we got super lucky by being in the right place at the right time and literally building the right product and the benefits we're seeing right now. So e-commerce was supposed to grow. It was growing anyways, but because of coronavirus or COVID-19, the growth that was supposed to happen over the next 2 to 3 years literally happened in the last
30 days.
Yeah. So what we have seen is crazy acceleration, because a lot of companies that were offline are going online just to sustain themselves. So that's one good change that we've seen. And the second one is, well, people can buy through retail anymore. Like, the retail stores are closed, malls are closed. So everyone has started buying online. So just by e-commerce sales, the GMV flowing through e-commerce has increased. So even though, like, economy is in recession right now, the consumer spending is down, but if you look at the e-commerce spending, that's actually same or slightly up. And that is the proof point where more and more people are now buying online and more businesses are coming online. So this will continue to grow even in the future. So I think we just happen to be lucky where back in 2014, 2015, e-commerce was booming, and now in 2020, things are just getting accelerated, and we're at a scale where we can actually capitalize on some of these acceleration and these secular market trends.
Yeah, I mean, to be, you know, I don't think, and I've said this on a couple of shows, obviously, not just about logistics, but we advance society depending on the industry you're in. I talk a lot about media and remote working and payments and e-commerce, retail, etc. Depending on where you are, the last 3 years, 5 years, or 10 years has evolved in 30 to 45 days. And I really sincerely don't think that it's going to go backwards. I think that people, myself included, we talked about before the show, the convenience factor and the efficiency factor for me on my work, and I have nothing to do with your kind of business for the most part, is up maybe 25, maybe more percent, because I've basically pulled out of the waste of time stuff and the travel and the just the things that I did. I did it because that's what we did, right? And it wasn't like a thought. And now it is. And now I think anytime I have an opportunity to invest in something that's on the e-commerce side, like I know what I'm looking for. CAC, LTV, like, do you know what you're doing? And I think that there's so many more opportunities are going to come, and there's just only going to be more velocity in your business. There's going to be even more access to companies that previously might have thought, we're not even going to get into this because Walmart, Target, Amazon, they're crushing. There's no space. Now it's like, well, yeah, I can compete. I've got a good product. I've got a good price. I can compete on shipping overnight. I can compete in every level. In some cases, actually do better when it comes to conversion on social media because they're more nimble. So I think that there's this ridiculous upside for the market and also for your business, of course. What do you think as far as, you know, not just in this corona circumstance, but like we fast forward, I don't even know, is it 1 month, 50 months? I have no idea how long this is going to be. But fast forward out of corona, where do you see business going? What do you see as changes you guys are kind of looking at to make sure that you're ready for? What are you going to get lucky at again, as they say?
Yeah, I think if we, like, it's just hypotheses. I wish I knew the answers. And we would be in a different position if I knew what would happen.
Hey, I just watched Back to the Future 2, and he was able to get the 1958 to 2000 almanac. So, you know, let's pretend we have it.
Yeah. No, I think on a high level, this e-commerce secular trends are going to stay. People are going to be like a little hesitant to buy from retail stores in general. And the convenience of e-commerce, if you can get it within the next day or so, that'll be a pretty important consumer factor. But on top of this, what will also happen is the biggest reason why people would go into retail stores was a bit of personalization. They were looking for something that they can connect with. They can try. They can see what they're getting and kind of get that experience. So what will happen from now is essentially, well, Amazon will continue to do well for commodity products. That retail segment will kind of get exchanged or like will give way to some of these more personalized brands or direct-to-consumer brands, which are resonating more to the consumers. So while earlier people would have bought, let's say, a hand sanitizer, which is Purell hand sanitizers from Amazon or Costco, but now because they want to have a better statement of, okay, I need a more moisturizing hand sanitizer that doesn't dry my hand or smells like this, people will start looking for those experiences that were typically meant for retail, that where you go, you smell, you discover things. Now that'll even translate more into online, where people would start looking for a brand that they can connect with, something that they were looking for. And as a result, these direct-to-consumer e-commerce brands or these small to mid-size e-commerce businesses will see more and more traction. And we have the early proof points in the past 4 to 6 weeks. We've seen our existing customer base, our existing direct-to-consumer brands, they've grown incredibly as well. I'm talking literally month over month, 60 to 80% on average, we are seeing these brands grow. And that's mostly because people are looking for these items that they can connect with, these small luxuries. I'm not talking a Louis Vuitton handbag. I'm just saying a good-smelling hand sanitizer or, let's say, a protein bar that I really want to have when I'm home, because now I cannot go out into a restaurant and eat a luxurious meal. So these small luxuries have started taking off, and we're seeing the growth, and I think this will continue to go on for the next N number of years.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think that you bring up the food, I don't know, food element, but like, this whole corona thing, obviously, I didn't like going grocery shopping before. I really am not going grocery shopping now with people coughing all around me and not following the 6 foot distance. I have no interest in it. But what I've learned is now with delivery and the things that we're doing, and we use Tavala and some other things, I will not go into the stores unless I really, really need to, or I'm craving a personal experience, which I think does two things. It creates, you know, one, it, well, I guess three things. One, it validates everything you're just saying, but like two, it creates an opportunity for those who do invest in real estate to create, you know, unique experiences that people will covet and warrant. It will be, you know, it would be shameful for a Toys R Us to happen again. Like to have that kind of a big box and not use the space to entertain the people who are there and make them feel like they're a part of your brand so that they buy, you know, there, but they also buy your stuff online. It's a great opportunity to reuse or rethink the space. That's one. Two, I actually think there's a gigantic opportunity, and you look at a local company like Three Kit that is creating sort of AR experiences that enable you to have essentially trying on the clothing, trying out the sofa, trying out, you know, whatever it is, looking at the food in a three-dimensional way, looking at whatever, what, you know, a car, whatever you're doing. Carvana has got to be going through the roof right now, I would think. There are so many really unique opportunities that I think are just going to make the experience even better, which ultimately for you is good business. But for investors, for founders, yeah, you know, there's some hardship here and people are tightening up the belt a little bit and yada, yada, yada. But like at the end of the day, and of course there's the cost of life and things that are political and, you know, I try to avoid getting into that, but the positive in my mind of this disruption for tech, I think far outweighs the capital restraints we're dealing with right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's to be seen, but essentially if you look back into the last recession as well, there was tightening of capital around the globe and the country as well. But that resulted into like some of the best startups to emerge and scale from there. Like Uber capitalized on the unemployment where people didn't have full-time jobs. So gig work came about. Airbnb, people had space in their home. Well, Airbnb capitalized on these things where people needed additional income. So that was the last recession. Now this recession, it's anyone's guess where things will land and which startups will like scale from here. But there are definitely some secular trends for some industries that will definitely benefit from this. E-commerce being one, online gaming, e-gaming being another one. While restaurants are hurting, cloud kitchens should traditionally will start doing better because, well, they don't have that fixed overhead like traditional restaurants. So these are some of the industries that should get some benefit. The next best startups or the next 10 years will emerge from the ashes during these times.
I totally agree with you. And I think you named almost all of them I can think of. I mean, the cloud kitchen thing is, and it's ironic, right? That Uber was Travis Kalanick and then cloud kitchen is Travis Kalanick again. It's like this dude, and that guy is the guy who's got the crystal ball. There's no question. But you know, I think you're right. I think you look at, you know, media, has a huge opportunity. Esports is, I think, getting the nudge in the ass that they needed for all this time. All the people, particularly advertisers, who said that they didn't, you know, they didn't want to have their brand associated with some of the things that go on esports and chat logs. Now we're like, it's the only way we have to connect with people right now. And they're seeing gigantic success. I think that's going to blow up. I think, you know, on-demand video virtual experiences are going to be ginormous. I think companies we'll have learned a little bit of a lesson here that it's like, oh, we really need to invest in having experiences both virtually and in person, because you could lose either tech or apparently our ability to go out and about in a flash. So I totally think you're right. I want to end on a note of taking advantage of what you've learned in this journey. So if you were somebody out there who's trying to capitalize and come out of the ashes with a great opportunity, how would you recommend some of these entrepreneurs and founders approach this liftoff, as opposed to maybe the days of high flying capital? What would be your way if you were to start this again, or start something else and capitalize on it? What would be the approach that you would take?
Yeah, I think this is the time where capital is tight. So the focus on unit economics should be more than ever. So gone are the days where people would be writing checks left and right for any company or any SaaS company. There'll be more thoughtful investments. So like just the burden of proof now lies on the essentially the entrepreneur to prove that unit economics is working from pretty much day one. So the heavy investments that one could make to show future track record is gone. So I would say all the companies that are starting now, like the biggest focus will be profitability, or at least showing positive unit economics from day zero. And that way is like the best companies will be formed right now and they'll succeed without any capital. So I think bootstrapping and then showing positive unit economics from the get-go will be a pretty good indicator. And eventually those will be the companies that will get funded once the capital is more free flowing.
Completely agree. I love it. And obviously congratulations on all your success. You guys still have a long way to go, but you're definitely one of the companies that I think about frequently when I think of all of the greats on stage. So I appreciate you taking the time. And where do companies go to learn more and to work with you guys?
Yeah, so our website is shipbob.com, so shipbob.com, and you can see there. And if you happen to be an e-commerce entrepreneur, happy to help out in any way we can, you can sign up on our website and we can go from there.
Still one of the all-time great names, ShipBob.
Yep. And one of the best stories ever told on a Technori stage as well, I believe.